weekdays from 4.
105 Drive with Julian Clover.
Seeing you home.
A new book explores the proud history of the world-leading Cavendish Laboratory. Its author is Professor Malcolm Longair, and I'm pleased to say that he's with you now. Good evening, Malcolm.
Good evening.
Thank you very much for coming in. There's so much history, really, around Cambridge. It's always difficult to know where to start, but at least we can narrow it down in particular. Start off, though, by telling us as to why you've given the book the title that you've given it, Maxwell's Enduring Legacy.
It is something I feel very passionately about. That James Clerk Maxwell was the founding director and the first Cavendish professor of the laboratory when it was founded in 1871. And at that time, he gave a wonderful inaugural address in which he described precisely what our present vision is for how physics should not only be doing physics for its own sake, but serving the community, training people in problem-solving skills, teaching them to use their hands to do experiments, use all their faculties to understand how nature works.
And what sort of man was he? What had he done in the lead-up to the establishment of Cavendish?
He was recognised when he was appointed as one of the very top theoretical and experimental physicists in the UK. And he was the obvious choice when some other people were unavailable to take the job. His work, it was in the understanding of heat, and he published his work on electromagnetism. The problem he had was that one could not, at that stage, prove the correctness of these theories by laboratory experiments. And in fact, much of this only happened after his sad death, after only 8 years in the post.
Right. So, moving on from that, as one of almost, I suppose, going forward in time, people are sort of checking the work and just finding it was correct anyway.
It's not quite that simple.
No, I didn't think it would be somehow.
Because at all stages you're pushing against the limits of what can be done experimentally, and so there was not really the tools to be able to do it until the further development of experimental and technical technique that could make that all possible. But of course, same story recurs throughout the whole history of the laboratory, getting new techniques, using new discoveries to study nature in new ways. And that's what led to the great discoveries which are associated with the laboratory.
I was going to say, we need to go through some of those as if we needed to remind people of what they were.
As if we need to remind ourselves, exactly. You know, the discovery of the electron by J.J. Thomson, the discovery of the neutron by Chadwick, the discovery of the DNA molecule by Crick and Watson, the discovery of pulsars and neutron stars by Tony Hewish. The list goes on and on and on. And again, the striking thing about this evolution of the laboratory is how it has been able to change. It hasn't remained static. It's been a dynamic entity, changing its approach almost professorship by professorship to the changing goals of physics research.
Because it's interesting that the front cover of your book, it doesn't have an old-fashioned photograph, something in black and white of a college we could just about recognise. It has a brightly covered brand new building, which has only, I think, been completed in recent months.
Indeed, it was opened on the 7th of April this year, and this is entirely intentional. I want this to be a forward-looking book, saying how can we build on the lessons of the past to solve things now. The history comes right up to date at the present time to 2016, and one should try to read the book in a way of seeing it, the discipline evolving in wave upon wave, and the priorities changing. That's what keeps it alive.
And what have been the influences on it? Obviously, the discoveries and the desire to go on and build more around the work, but presumably government has had an influence as well, as in addition to the thinking of the day.
There's a very, very large number of different vectors, if I put it that way, coming in, which determines the direction of the programme. There's what you're very good at. There are the innovations that you've been able to build upon to do new things in new ways. There are government priorities wishing us to do things which are of value to society. And in a way, all of these come together in a great meld, and you never quite know which directions are going to be the ones which are important fundamentally or for society. So, for example, we've started up a big programme in the physics of sustainability, trying to apply fundamental physics to solve things like energy production, battery storage, refrigeration, light production, all of these sorts of things which are fundamentally challenging and at the same time very valuable to society.
And I suppose there are projects in the same way that the laboratory has had great successes where people spend goodness knows how many months working only to discover that it's not taking them in the direction of which they hoped.
Oh, that's all part of the game. That most of your ideas are wrong. And it's the one or two that are right, where you have to be recognised and say, look, here is something new that is not understood. If I can give you one example, Rutherford, Ernest Rutherford, was one of the great Cavendish professors, and his genius was to leave no stone unturned. Everything in the experiments had to be understood. He discovered that radioactivity changed when he opened or shut a door. And the reason was gas was being produced, and so the drafts would remove the radioactivity. But you've got to have this nose for understanding what it is that is happening in your experiment. So it's this meticulous care and taking your opportunity when it comes is the exciting thing.
And you yourself have spent many a year, dare I say, at the laboratory. Tell me when you first stepped foot inside.
Well, I joined in as a graduate student in 1963, and I was then became a lecturer. I was in Scotland for 11 years and then came back to a professorship in 1991. And then I ran the laboratory for 8 years, so I had a good inside understanding of the dynamic between the very large number of people in the laboratory.
And the difference between between 63 and 91, what had changed when you went back? Was there anything noticeable?
Well, the big change, of course, was the way in which the technology had moved on. What had moved, computers now were so much faster, enabling you to do experiments you couldn't conceivably have even perceived before. Things had been discovered which changed the whole attitude towards the whole discipline. So there's many, many things happening simultaneously, and you must be sensitive to all the things that are going on about you.
And I suppose the individual projects have to talk with each other as well, don't they, to make sure that they're not sort of crisscrossing or ending up doing the same work, inadvertently on two different projects. Maybe it doesn't matter, I don't know.
Our philosophy has always been to allow the scientists to do what they want to do. We don't direct them. They've got to be self-directed, self-motivated. If they happen to overlap, we hope people collaborate, but they don't have to. It's the individual inspiration it's this liberty to use your imagination in your own way, which is really the key to success.
And I have to ask, still sort of feeling the shock waves, or at the very least the ripples of Brexit, are there any concerns from Cavendish that a move out of the European Union might result in less funding for this particular sector?
Well, this was very, very disappointing from the point of view of the whole research community, because we have been benefiting enormously from European funding for research programmes to an enormous extent. We actually get back more than our fair share, and everybody knows that. And so cutting us off in the long term, potentially, from that source is a very dangerous and very difficult thing. So we've got to hope that we will find ways of being able to maintain our science is totally international. We work with everyone, and that's the best way to get the best minds, and we want the best minds to come to Cambridge from all over the world and Europe. So we just can't conceive of not working internationally.
So that's going to happen anyway, and you then have to, I guess, apply to different places for the money, to hope that money not going to Europe comes the way of investment in British science programmes?
We've got to find ways of solving this problem. I think it's too early to speculate what the outcome of negotiations will be, but it is plainly something which is absolutely crucial to enable us to get the best minds from Europe to come and work with us.
Very, very much so. And some of those best minds, as we've been hearing, have been at the Cavendish Laboratory over the years. Professor Longair, thank you very much for coming to talk to us tonight. And I should say that book, Maxwell's Enduring Legacy, is published by Cambridge University Press, and I guess it's available at all good bookshelves, sellers.
Indeed it is, yes.
thanks very much for coming in. It is 5:42.